Hello, Combi Nation. My name is Subi Sadeh. I've spent over a decade in medical device, pharma, and combination product development. Our industry feels complicated sometimes. Drugs, devices, clinical trials, submissions, sterilization, validation, design control, risk management, market access, reimbursement. The list goes on. My goal is mastery. So this podcast is to ask questions I have to people who may have the answers. Each week on the Combinate podcast, I talk to someone about their area to further understand and simplify. Whether you're a pharma person trying to understand the next wave of products, or a device person trying to navigate a pharma system you're unfamiliar with, or a newbie in both areas, I invite you to listen, and together we can simplify by combinating. Hi, everybody, and welcome to this special episode of the Combinate podcast. I'm your host, Subi Sadeh, and we are graced today and honored by Naveen Agarwal. Naveen is a risk management, I don't want to say expert because he doesn't like that word. Maybe introduce the initiatives that you're working through, Naveen.
That's awesome. Subi, thank you for having me again. I've enjoyed my past conversations with you and really, really appreciate another opportunity to have a conversation with you. So just to pick up on your use of the word expert, and I really don't like that word because expert is more about a person. When we say someone is expert, we are focused on the person and not necessarily, you know, what they have to say and what they can do. And many times that is, in my opinion, not the right thing because in today's world, nobody has all the answers. And if they claim to have the answer, actually they are fooling you. So no one is an expert. And I think the real sort of point here is, can we help each other ask the right questions? Not necessarily give the answer. So that is where I like to see myself as sort of an explorer, as a curious explorer.
A mentor of mine recommended a book to me called Seeing David in the Stone. And one of the axioms in the book is to focus on creating rather than consuming. So I won't call you an expert. I'll say, from my perspective, you create more than you consume. How's that?
Yes, that sounds good. And the reason I create to be is because of my sort of insatiable curiosity about risk management. Because here's a simple question that continues to baffle me. And I focus on that almost every day as I read, think, and write. The question is this, and I'm talking about mostly our industry, which is the medical device industry, very heavily focused on risk. Now we talk about risk management in the context of safety, but there's a lot more to talk about risk beyond just safety. And we have talked about that in the past and I've written about that. But the question that baffles me is this, is why does it seem so hard? Why does it seem so difficult when in our daily lives, we are making countless risk-based decisions. So what happens? Why does it become so hard? Why do we keep talking about ISO 14971, ISO TR24971, this regulation, that regulation? And we read those regulations and the language, honestly, is confusing. I mean, I have read them more than 100 times. And still, I find myself pausing on each word, each phrase, trying to figure it out. So I'm baffled by it. And that is what makes me curious. That's what makes me think about things in a different way and push the boundaries of our conversation a little bit. And I like to call my approach as provocative, but not confrontational. So I want to engage, but not for the sake of just having small talk, but for the purpose of exploring together what things mean, how we can make better decisions. So that's what I focus on. You asked me what I focus on. Is really my focus nearly 100% of the time is my Let's Talk Risk newsletter. So that is where I'm sharing my ideas, my insights. And I also do this Friday casual conversation I call Let's Talk Risk Conversation. It's basically we are trying to engage and encourage people to be curious and be open to have a conversation. That's what my focus is.
Excellent. Well, in that same book, one of the other kind of axioms is to build knowledge based on existing experiences and expertise of others, but to also push it forward by trying to poke holes and be provocative. So it sounds like you're two for two there. Yeah. So diving straight into the question, Naveen, I recently heard a podcast that was talking about some of the delineations between FMEA and 14971 and how some areas of industry still haven't maybe adopted the risk management framework set forth in the standards and guidelines appropriately. In my experience, I haven't really seen that as an issue, whether it's the companies that I've worked at or the suppliers and CXO partners that I've worked with. Everybody seems to understand that if you are going to use an FMEA, at least the DFMEA in particular, or use FMEA, that it needs to link to patient harm in one way, shape, or form. So yes, you have the effect of failure in the FMEA be some kind of failure of the device, but what does that mean for the patient? That's a critical link, and your risk control is to that level. And there's P1, P2, and all of that that's described in 24971, but is this an issue that you've seen?
Okay, so first thing that I would like to clarify for everybody is that ISO 14971 does not call out FMEA at right. all. ISO 14971 is about risk, and a particular type of risk. That is the risk of harm, and they've defined the harm, and they define the term risk. It is not talking about all kinds of risks. It is talking about a specific type of risk, and it is leaving to us practitioners, to figure out how to identify those risks, analyze our risk control options, implement them effectively, monitor them on an ongoing basis. So I don't want us to feel as if ISO 14971 is asking us to do FMEA. I don't want us to say that ISO 14971 is telling us do XYZ. ISO 14971 is just telling us to understand the risks that we have to focus on. Having said that, industry practice has been to use an FMEA. And it goes way back even before ISO 14971 started. And I actually have a full module on the history of 14971 in my training course. I think it's very important for us to understand where 14971 came from and what kind of struggles it has gone through in trying to understand the industry, what risk is from a safety point of view. So let's set that straight. There is no correlation between 14971 and FMEA. So there is no,
okay, so
should not be a conversation like FMEA versus 14971.
And they even mentioned that in that podcast. They said it's not really a versus, it's more of a perceived compliance by using FMEA. Yeah.
No.
When they're missing gaps. I suppose
that's a good point.
Completely understand what you're saying about 14971. It doesn't say any tools. I don't even think it says, it doesn't even say hazard analysis per se, right?
Well, it provides a background about appropriate tools that could be relevant in 24971.
24971, I think does maybe say DFMEA as a tool. But
it describes FMEA as a potential relevant technique. That's what it does.
Yeah. Okay. So let's say design per se. Can you design a new product? I personally haven't seen this, so that's why I'm asking. Can you design a new product without following some kind of DFMEA framework to lead you to those things that would potentially cause patient harm that are related to design risk? Like what other design risk tools are there? I mean, I know there's fault tree analysis and a couple of others, but it still doesn't satisfy that fully comprehensive, this component interacting with that component, the subsystem interacting with that. And here's what it's supposed to do. Here's what, go ahead.
Yeah, I understand your question, really. And it's a good point you make, is that there is a sense in the industry that by following FMEA, we're going to comply with ISO 14971, or we will be considered compliant, right? So that's a separate question. Your other question is more relevant. My view is FMEA is a very, very useful technique. Very useful, if done right, but it is not sufficient. That's my view. And I'll explain that how. So FMEA is basically a very structured tool to talk about single fault situations, identify their potential causes and their potential effects. So it's a one-to-many relationship. Okay? And you do that in a systematic way. And the focus really is on meeting design requirements. Keep in mind that design requirements can be broader, more than just safety requirements. So when you design a product, you have to meet all the design requirements and you find ways in which potentially the design of the product that you are thinking about or working on fails to meet those requirements. And then you identify the causes of those potential failures and effects of those failures. So that's the big picture, right? So if you take a step back and don't worry about ISO 14971 or anything else, you come to the conclusion that your job in an FMEA really is to produce a product which reliably meets design requirements. It's a failure risk analysis tool. So if done right, you will estimate the probability of a certain failure mode caused by a certain cause with a certain effect. It's a very specific combination of three things. And you need to estimate the probability of occurrence of that. Right? So it is optional for you to include severity in an FMEA. You could say, I don't have to do that because my job as an engineer should be to minimize the probability of the occurrence of a specific failure mode caused by a certain cause with a certain effect to as much as possible. That's what I should do as an engineer. So severity is optional, but many people do that for good reason because you have finite resources. You want to prioritize your resources to work on those that directly impact something that has a high consequence. So fine, include severity, right? You could do that. Now, severity doesn't have to always relate to the severity of the harm. It could be severity of other consequences, which are important, but not necessarily related to safety. That's the big picture, right? So FMEA can be a very good...
Hold on. That last part, the severity of other consequences, can you describe that a little more?
Well, it depends upon your design requirements, right? Let's say you are thinking about reducing the... I'm making this up on the top of my head, right? Let's say you're thinking about doing something that is more convenient, reduces the surgery time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So... Then you have to think about, of course, there are safety considerations also. There'll be other considerations. But let's say you focus on delivering on reduction of the surgery time by X percent. And you're going to say that, hey, if we don't deliver on that, and this is, again, a very made-up scenario, our product is not going to be competitive in the market. We won't have adoption. We lose market share by X percent. No growth. It's important to the business and the business requires you to design a product that can deliver on that, but it has nothing to do with safety.
Sorry, you see me smiling because this goes back to the beginning because that sounds like an RPN. PFMEA means the line will stop. It means product will have to be quarantined. It means so on. That's what I've seen with a lot of the PFMEA severity scoring. And that's kind of going back to the I feel like what you're describing sounds to me like the legacy severities from the pre-patient risk related FMEA.
No, not necessarily. I'm just using that as an example to show you that severity could be a consequence of something that is important to you, that is important for the product design. And the point I'm trying to make is that as far as the product design is concerned, safety is not the only criteria, not the only deliverable. So as a designer, you have to keep in mind everything. And you mentioned RPN. RPN is just like a method of prioritization, right? That's what it is. There should be no threshold, no cutoffs. It should be highest to lowest, and you start working from top to bottom. That's what FMEA is supposed to do. It's a decision-making tool. It's a tool to identify where you should prioritize your work, and the job of the engineer is never finished.
I'm sorry, you see me. You see me smiling because every RPN scoring that I've seen has had red, yellow, green thresholds.
Yeah,
whatever
I don't
call
really
those. You don't agree with that? Okay.
No.
Okay. So
you should not be doing that in an FMEA at all.
Okay. So what you're saying is that severity of harm is optional in an FMEA, and the benefit of doing it in that fashion allows the engineers to use FMEA to look at things beyond only safety risks. Things that would
clarify is that inclusion of severity as a criteria or consideration is optional. You could choose to focus only on probability of occurrence if you want to.
Yeah.
But inclusion of severity, and also severity now is broader, not just severity of harm. Inclusion of a measure of consequence of that failure effect allows you to prioritize your activities. That's what I'm trying to say.
Understood.
And there is no reason why you should have any acceptability criteria in an FMEA. The only criteria is continual improvement of reliability. So we'll keep working on them, keep reducing if you choose to do RPN, which is what I favor. If you choose to use the RPN measure, there's no red, yellow, green. It's highest to lowest. And our drive is continually reducing the level of RPN to the extent possible.
And so how would you link it to patient harm?
Okay, so let's talk about that. So first, I will briefly comment on why you may not have seen this approach in our industry.
That's what I was going to say too, is that what you're saying seems not the norm.
Not the norm. It's not the norm. And that is the reason, again, this is my opinion only based on my experience, is because we are not using FMEA in our industry for any good engineering work. We are using it as a piece of paper to show compliance to 14970. Period. And let's be honest about that. Okay. And if I were an auditor being presented with an FMEA as a risk analysis tool, as the only risk analysis tool, we'll have some interesting conversations. So the reason why we don't see it, because our focus is compliance, not reliability per se, explicitly. Nobody wants to make unreliable products by design. Nobody wants to make unsafe products by design. Engineers do a lot of good work and they are very good. We have good products. But are we using FMEA for the purpose of that, or are we using FMEA just as a piece of document to show somebody that we have done risk analysis? So I express to you my opinion, frankly, and it's my opinion only. And I would love to hear from others who have deployed FMEA very successfully and would love to learn from them as well.
Okay. So to reiterate what you just said, the issue, there is no inherent issue with using FMEA and tying it to patient harm together. The problem, though, is that there's a perception that you are being compliant by using FMEA, and it almost becomes a crutch to not use it as an engineering tool. Like the idea of using it as an engineering tool, layering on patient risk, there's no inherent problem with that. But
let me add a little bit to that. There is a nuanced explanation. There's no problem with that, but it is not sufficient. It is not complete.
Yeah.
And the reason it's not complete is because patient harm can occur even when there is no failure. And the patient harm is a many to one. So let me briefly explain that to you. We understand that FMEA is a one to many activity, one to many sort of analysis tool, where one failure mode could have multiple potential causes and each of them could be related to multiple effects. So it's a one-to-many relationship. Patient harm, on the other hand, is many-to-one. Many contributing factors could lead to a hazardous situation through sequence of events. And in one hazardous situation, you could have one or more potential harms. The gap from going from one to many and then many-to-one is that gap which we cannot address using an FMEA alone. And that is where we are struggling, because we are trying to show risk controls for 14971 in an FMEA, trying to make risk acceptability decisions where we can't be complete in a line by line, one to many relationship type of analytical tool.
Okay, so that makes a lot of sense. So to just so I have that clear, what you're saying is that when you look at FMEA, it's a one to many relationship where you may have one failure that can lead to a bunch of different things. You have a whole list of harms that happen from one failure, likely to unlikely. And then on the flip side, when you talk about harms, there are usually many contributing factors to a harm, and some of them can be product related, but you can have a perfect product and still cause patient harm. Is that why there's a distinction between medical device reporting, adverse event reporting, and because when those reports come out, it doesn't necessarily mean that there was a product failure?
Yes. But actually, if you look at MDR reports, and I've looked through a lot of them, many times you'll find that no identified device related issue as the device problem code, not related. We can figure out if it was caused by the device or not. Association is not the same as causation. MDR is because the device was associated with something that led to an adverse event. It's a malfunction, doesn't mean that the patients were harmed. So you have to look at the MDR data a little bit carefully, read the narratives, because there's some ongoing investigation, follow-up inquiry. And I'll quickly say this, Subi, that people use complaints data or adverse events data to estimate probabilities in an FMEA. That is not correct. Not right. And in fact, they should be prepared to kind of justify why they have used it, how they have used it, and whether those probabilities are actually reliable or not. And okay. FDA has issued several warning letters in this area. I'm going to just add that very quickly, where they have challenged the manufacturer's estimate of probabilities. So we have to start being very careful
really?
About it.
Can you share those, and I can put them in the show notes?
I don't have the numbers at the top of my head right now. I can follow up with
them.
But there are a couple of warning letters where FDA has directly challenged the estimate of the probability of harm. And I think that people should take that a little bit seriously in terms of how we are using them to make risk-based decisions or risk control decisions.
Understood. So let's go back to FMEAs. So where we stopped, I think, was if you were to use an RPN kind of FMEA and use it as an engineering tool, how would you bring patient risk into that?
Very good question. So my approach is not to talk about probability of harm in an FMEA. My approach is to focus entirely on probability of failure. So I will have an FMEA where probability of occurrence is not the probability of occurrence of harm, but it's a probability of occurrence of that failure mode caused by that specific call with that specific effect. So each line will have its probability of occurrence estimated. Now, having said that, now I need to do something else on the side to sort of relate device failures and user actions, maybe use errors that I may have analyzed separately in sequence of events and link them to hazards and hazardous situations. I have to do that work. I have to build that work of now connecting all this work I have done, maybe in the process FMEA, software FMEA, design FMEA. I don't like to call use FMEA. I like to call it use error analysis. Maybe we have done that work. Now I have to bring it all together. To go from many to one, that's a separate activity. In that tool, I use estimation of probability of harm. Either I can use a P1, P2 approach, or I can use a direct POH approach. So I don't use probability of harm in an FMEA at all. I do that separately. FMEA is sort of think of it as a component of my risk analysis, not
sure.
The entire risk.
So what would that look like in application? Would there be, I'm trying to, okay. So in my experience, you have hazard analysis or hazard list, depending on what companies will do. That's like the first thing, list all the harms that can happen. And then you have your FMEAs that will look at line by line, component by component, use error by use error, process step by process step, analyze what could go wrong, and then tie that to the harm.
Correct.
The HA may have your P2, and the P1 comes from the PFMEA, and the probability of harm would be the combination of the two times with the severity. So I'm just trying to understand, would it be an FMEA, a bridge report that speaks to the probability, and then an HA, or how would you structure that?
Let me describe to you very simply. It's actually a whole module in my training course. And let me clarify what I mean by hazard analysis. Hazard analysis is a very strong component of this risk analysis process that I teach. And hazard analysis means different things to different people. There's a lot of work done in that area. What it means to me is sort of a worksheet where you have identified hazards and you have linked each hazard to one or more hazardous situations, to one or more harms through sequence of events. So the left side of a hazard analysis to me looked like each line will be one hazard, one sequence of events, one hazardous situation, one harm, and the same hazard could be linked to another hazardous situation to either the same harm or another harm. So I'll have multiple lines in my hazard analysis workbook on the left-hand side. So now I have a connection between hazards, hazardous situations, and harms on the left-hand side. In an FMEA, on the left-hand side, I have a connection between failure modes, causes, and effects. What I need to do is to understand the linkage to a potential hazard in an FMEA so that I can connect different failure modes and aggregate them to a hazard-hazardous situation combination in my hazard analysis workbook. So giving you an example of, let's say, in my work, done a lot of work in the ophthalmology space with intraocular lenses or contact lenses. So let's take a very quick example. So let's say we are talking about an intraocular lens, which now the doctor, after surgery, notices that it's moving too much inside the eye. And as a result, the patient is complaining of poor vision outcomes. We don't know if the lens was designed incorrectly. We don't know if the patient's capsular bag was weak. We don't know if something happened during surgery that the lens was not placed properly. We could have 10 different reasons why the lens is moving. But the movement of the lens now is sort of a hazardous situation. That lens movement is leading to a poor vision outcome. So in my hazard analysis, I'll identify maybe, let's say, lens stability as a factor. I could relate to a functional spec, for example. I could relate to multiple things. But let's say some hazard. Let's say lens movement as a hazard. I'll have to define what the hazard is, right? Lens position, whatever I want to call it. And I don't want to get hung up on terminology. But the hazardous situation is patient is moving around with an unstable lens in their eye. That's the left side. Now, I need to go into my FMEAs and link every failure mode that I think could cause unstable positioning of a lens to this hazard that I've identified in my hazard analysis.
Right. And so that's the question that I'm asking, because in my experience, the FMEA would make that link.
No. FMEA will
have
only one.
So that's what I'm asking. But that's what I'm asking.
I'm going to tell you, I'm going to describe. This is like a full lesson that you're getting right now. So in your FMEA, let's call this specific hazard as H1. Okay. I'll have 10 lines maybe in my FMEA that'll point to H1, right?
Yeah.
And each one of those lines would be a distinct combination of failure mode, cause, and effect. Different cause. But I'll have 10 lines.
What you're saying is you wouldn't define that in your FMEA, but you would trace to it.
You would trace each effect of a failure mode to one or more hazards.
For example, let's say there's a use error where the user puts in their contact lens backwards. I think that's not a thing, but let's say it was rigid. Let's say it's a rigid contact lens.
Yeah.
Where putting it in backwards would actually, yeah. Let's say it puts it in, they put it in backwards and the hazardous situation is, among other things, that there's contact lens movement within within the eye, you would say that's a failure mode. H1 is
no, I wouldn't call it a failure mode. First of all, I wouldn't have that in an FMEA. I would have that in the user analysis.
In the user, but I'm trying to use UFMEA as an example.
So that'll be traced to H1.
Okay.
But in my design FMEA also, I might have, let's say, incorrect diameter. I might have, say, incorrect stabilizing elements. There are stabilizing elements in an IOL. Okay, sure. We don't want to go too technical. Maybe incorrect. We'll have all those lines. And each one of those will map to a one hazard. So what I need to do, Subi, and this is where people get wrong, we need to aggregate. We need to trace and aggregate one or more contributing factors and map them to a single hazard-hazardous situation combination in a separate tool. There, now I can do a composite probability of occurrence of a hazardous situation. I could do a fault tree analysis. I could do some assumptions. It won't be a single failure mode. It could be one or more contributing factors, and I'll have to estimate a compound probability.
You're saying that a bunch of different failures would cause a certain hazardous situation to occur, and so you should focus on what are all the things that would cause that hazardous situation instead of saying looking at it as a, we need to control this failure.
Yes. Let me build on that to describe this situation, right? I think a lot of the confusion has occurred because we seem to think of a harm occurring in a sequential way. We have to expand our thinking that it's not A leading to B leading to C to D, E, and F. It could be multiple streams of multiple trajectories of a certain fault leading to a hazardous situation or a certain use error leading to a hazardous situation. We can't really foresee all of them.
So that's what I wanted that's kind of what I wanted to get at, because I know 14971 doesn't say this, but 24971 has the PA, PB, PC, PD. Yes. And you mentioned earlier that FMEAs are single fault. And so what tools are there to look at multi-fault or things where it's not that linear?
Yes. So there are two tools that I can mention that I think can work very well, and they need to be done back and forth. And they are, by the way, included in TR-24971. I just haven't seen effective uses of that. The first one we all know is fault tree analysis. Fault tree analysis allows us to build relationship to a top event and the underlying bottom events. The other tool is event tree analysis, which actually allows us to project forward, okay? So some people can think in that way is that a top event tool is related to underlying events in some ways, and this same top event tool, same top event could lead to multiple sequence of events in future.
So okay? What's the difference between a fault tree and an event tree?
So fault tree is top to bottom down. An event tree is starting from an event and projecting forward what else might happen. And that is where you build a sequence of events. TR-24971 provides only one example, and it is very clear in telling people this is not the only example. It gives you an example of how a cascade of events could happen. So think of it as one branch of your event tree. There could be multiple branches in your event tree, and you have to articulate that. And you can do that as purely an engineering exercise in the context of harm, and that is where you have to involve your medical safety or clinical specialists who can actually help you understand what additional events could be triggered in an operating room starting from an initial event. So here'll be my recommendation. You involve your engineers in the fault tree development and FMEA development. Don't overload them with projecting forward up to harm. They are not competent to do so. And you involve your medical and clinical specialists into building your event trees starting from top events. And those top events could be device failure or use errors. Then you talk about what else now could happen that will lead to hazardous situations. So it's basically has to be like a and has to be done back and forth. Like you will do to a certain extent during development, maybe you learn something through clinical trials, refine that. At launch, do the best you can. But in post-market, continue to build these sequences of events. Especially, one thing I'll flag that we are not doing is reasonably foreseeable misuse. I think this is where there's a lot of opportunity. We need to learn about what are the foreseeable misuses that we didn't foresee before. And how do they lead to new sequence of events, new hazardous situation? We are missing a lot on that. And that is why in MDRs, Subi, you don't find a clear connectivity between device malfunctions and injuries in most cases in general. Many times there is a clear connection, but a lot of times there's not, because we don't have that sequence of event clearly identified. We haven't worked on it. So it's a huge gap, in my opinion, as far as risk analysis is concerned.
I suppose I want to go back to FMEAs here and just say that I think the link to patient harm, whether it's done through an RPN FMEA or otherwise, I think that's pretty common in industry. Where I think I've seen issues, particularly in working with external partners or component manufacturers and things like that, is it becomes much harder or it's perceived as it's much more difficult to do this when you're talking about process FMEAs. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on that. We should not require process FMEAs to project forward all the way to hazardous situation and harm unless I qualify that it's an environmental control issue. If there is a process issue which really introduces a hazard that is directly related to harm, you should look into that. But I think by design, you should be controlling that anyway. So my preference, Subi, is to find a link, a direct link between design FMEA and PFMEA all the way down. So it's a hierarchical structure in my mind. Because Why have a process in the first place? The objective of the process is to produce this product to spec. That's it. So I need to have a linkage between my design FMEA line items and process FMEA line items where there's a relationship between potential causes that could lead to the process not being able to produce the part I want, a product I want. So I want to talk about top level effects, product level effects in the design FMEA, but I want to talk about how the process failure modes may link to that. And there should be a connectivity between the two. Some of the controls will be by design, some of the controls will be in the process.
Okay, understood. So what you're saying is let's use a basic example. Let's say it's a sterile barrier seal process, and the seal weld time is the critical process parameter. You would just identify that as something that is a critical CPP that needs to be defined in your design.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so I think
one of the causes of failure in the design would be the process failing to meet that CPP. And that's the linkage you will build between your design and process FM.
Okay. So you're saying the PFMEA should bridge into the DFMEA, which would make that link to the patient risk. And it shouldn't be a one-to-one, this process FMEA to HA kind of linkage. Because that's where it becomes much more cumbersome, pretty inefficient. And I've seen a bunch of different companies try to figure
and
that
lot
out.
A lot of speculation and assumptions. It makes the job of those who are doing PFMEAs a lot harder than it should.
10 times harder. Yeah.
And we are not getting the benefit out of it. The most I would suggest you could do, because I also help clients to kind of fix their current documentation without overhauling the whole system. What you could do is use the same strategy. You could map each failure mode to a hazard identified in your hazard analysis. And then you can aggregate failure modes from design, failure modes from process, aggregation, and trace them to a single hazardous situation combination.
Oh, so basically group them up.
So when somebody comes and tells you, Subi, show me your risk controls for this specific hazardous situation and hazard combination, will you walk them through 10 lines in DFMEA and 20 lines in PFMEA? Or would you rather combine everything? Because all those aggregated risk controls are addressing that hazardous situation, not one at a time. but all of them together, that's a completeness. That's a traceability that I would be looking for as an auditor.
That's interesting. Naveen, as we close, can you maybe talk about some of the stuff that you're working on in the background with risk management?
So Subi, what I have come to realize is that part of the reason why we have so much misunderstanding is because we don't have an ongoing conversation like this that we are having. We spend literally thousands of dollars getting trained and certified in risk management, but we don't have an ongoing support. We don't have an ongoing conversation and an opportunity to learn. That is what I'm trying to focus on and fix, because my long-term goal really is to help elevate our collective capability. I want to raise the bar. I'm not satisfied with where we are because I see a lot of waste and I don't see tangible improvement in patient safety. So I want to raise the bar so that we can not only improve patient safety, but accelerate innovation and reduce cost. How are we going to do that? By an ongoing conversation and thinking and curious questions and conversation. This is the focus of my Let's Talk Risk activities. So I'm very excited to tell you that in the just short span of 3 months, we have grown this newsletter to over 1,000 subscribers. All the big names in medical device industry, pharmaceutical, our readers are there from those companies. I know them. And I'm very excited to launch some premium features beginning August. People will have access to me one-on-one in a live webinar every month if you become a paid subscriber. And you will also get very huge discounts on my training and coaching courses where I go into that level of detail I went with you in this conversation. And that's the power of that. So I invite people to look at the newsletter. You don't have to become a paid subscriber. You will still have a lot of content available for free. But what I want above anything else is this ongoing conversation, ongoing dialogue.
Well, excellent, Naveen. Yeah, I think that's so important. And whether it's running or cycling or swimming or whatever, people do these training camps that are like a week long, super intensive.
Yeah.
And I think we see a lot of that type of training where it's like, okay, we're going to do a week training and then that's it. We've gotten everybody quote unquote trained, but there isn't that trickle. I mean, most of the important effects of any training program happens on the Tuesday afternoon session or the Thursday morning session. It's not the Saturday all day session that's most critical. It's the stuff that
and Subi, I'll link it very finely to the notion of competence. Remember 14971, 13485, we talk about competence.
That's right.
Competence is not the same as doing a course over 2 days getting certified. Competence builds over time. And that's what I'm focused on, helping people build their competence. And I'm going to talk about case studies and warning letters and deep dives, and not with the intention of giving them the right answer, but an analysis and case study method to help that conversation. So that's how I think we will build competence. And I see no resource right now available to practitioners in our industry.
Where can people find you, Naveen?
So they can find me on substack.com. They can find me on LinkedIn, and let's just have a conversation about risk management and help each other get better.
Well, thank you for coming on again, Naveen. As always, fun talking to you.
Thanks, Subi. Good luck with everything. Talk to you soon.